You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson and I'm joined by Guy Routledge. Good afternoon, Guy.
Good afternoon, Sue.
I feel like quite grown up today.
We've oh dear.
Grown up people here who've in big grown up businesses and feel like we're...
Well, we talk to all sorts of different people here on the Food Talk Show.
All sorts of different people. But I'm very, very pleased to have John Stapleton here, who's with Little Dish and also set up Covent Garden Soup Company.
He's been a busy man.
That's grown up.
That's quite grown up. Grown up flavours as well.
It is. And Stephen May from Smarter Applications and his company doing all sorts of very, very interesting things.
Very fancy tech.
Wait to talk to Stephen as
well. If it helps you at all, I'm not feeling very grown up.
Aren't you?
So, we'll bring a bit of balance to the show.
Yes. very good. John, hi there. It's very nice to see you.
Hello.
We met a few weeks ago, didn't we, and had a good old chat. And it'll be really nice, again, to talk about all your background. And I think, for me in particular, there's a lot of companies that we have on here, all sorts of producers, food producers and things. And the magic thing for them is being able to build a brand from scratch and then sell it and be very successful in the way you have. So it's going to be great to hear your story. Little Dish is very interesting too. But do you mind just kicking off and talking about the new Covent Garden Soup Company? And just for those of people who don't really know, you didn't used to be able to, trust me, this is true, you didn't used to be able to buy soup.
I hate that phrase.
You didn't used to be able to buy soup in anything other than a tin. I think that's true to say. And then all of a sudden, one day, these cartons, almost like Tetra Pak sort of cartons, started appearing in the chilled section, you know, where the orange juice was and things like that. And it was soup, and it was like proper soup as opposed to, you know, stuff in a can and Heinz
that luminous
and Baxter's.
Orange stuff.
Oof. Yeah. And how on earth did you come up with the idea of this? And what made you do it? I mean, if you think about it, it's a completely ridiculous thing to have gone and done.
Yes, and we were completely crazy to even think of doing it.
That's where all the best ideas start, though, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's one of the great advantages, I think, of you know, it's almost like ignorance is bliss. Mm. If you don't really know what you're at, there's no reason not to keep doing it. And I often say, if you know how high that mountain is that you're about to climb, sometimes you kind of balk and say, oh, that's for somebody else, or that's impossible, or it's not, you know, something I can do right now. Whereas if you don't really know, and we didn't really know, we were a bunch of happy amateurs getting on with it and doing something unusual. If you're halfway up the mountain before you figure out it's a big mountain, you've got to kind of carry on anyway.
Yeah, you've got no choice, have you, really? Yeah. I mean, socially, it's you know, you can't go around to people and go, oh, actually, I shouldn't really start in that. It was a mistake. You just have to sort of crack on.
And I'm sure that many of our listeners who have their own, you know, small businesses or small brands or early stage, they'd probably be very relieved to hear that, you know, it starts the same way, even when someone ends up being successful.
Well, you know, hindsight is wonderful. So you can always look back and post-rationalize all the decisions you made. But I try not to. And it's wonderful that we're feeling grown up, because certainly at the time, I didn't feel grown up.
I was
straight out of university and had no idea. And I met this guy called Andrew Palmer, who had the idea, but didn't really know how to go about doing it. And we basically, very long story short, put our heads together and decided to go and implement it. And it was one big adventure, like a roller coaster adventure.
And you had a food technology background anyway, hadn't you? You were doing that at university.
Yeah.
But so why did he have this idea? What spurred him on?
Well, exactly. He reckoned that he thought the quality of canned soup was atrocious. And it was, and it is, by comparison. And he really thought, and we both thought, that when you buy a premium quality product, let's say fresh soup, or let's say soup, then it really should taste of the ingredients you use to put into it, rather than the process you use to make it safe.
Yeah. What a funny novel concept.
Yeah, well, you see, that's what canning does. It makes it safe and gives it a long shelf life, and it's secure, and nothing wrong with that, except that it doesn't taste like what it's meant to taste like if it were fresh. So it tastes of the process, and you add a lot of stuff you really wouldn't add normally if you're about to make soup and eat it straight away or even the next day.
But you've got a supermarket packed with tins, you know, and there's a big section on the in the aisles devoted to tin soup. And then how did you manage to sell a concept to, which was so totally different at the time?
Well, yeah, you're so right. It was actually called the soup aisle. You know, if you wanted to buy soup, you went down the soup aisle.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like a self-fulfilled determination, if you like. You know, that's where you go to get soup. Except that's exactly what we wanted to point out, that you were buying canned soup, which didn't taste. Take tomato and cream of tomato. It doesn't taste of tomato. It tastes of a caramelized sugar substance. It tastes quite pleasant. Kids love it. It's great. There's nothing wrong with it, except it's, you know, if you get a
It has a taste of its own as opposed to tomato soup.
It doesn't taste like tomatoes. Yeah.
It's much more kind of like grilled tomatoes. They taste more like cooked tomatoes should taste. A little slightly metallic sort of tinge to it. So basically, we went to the retailers and said, look, we want to do something completely different. We actually thought, by the way, we were making soup for the first course of a dinner, because that's what, you know, soup tends to be associated with. So we went on that road and we decided we're not trying to attract the canned soup purchasers, because they're quite happy, obviously, with the quality of canned soup. We're trying to provide a solution to those who will never buy canned soup, because the quality isn't what they expect and what they need. They buy soup in a restaurant, they make it themselves. And of course, conveniently, we're saying you don't have to make it yourself. And then when we got it on the shelf, we found that actually people were buying it for all sorts of different reasons, typically for lunch. In their office as a meal replacement. And as an aspirational brand, people, I think, were very happy to be seen with a carton of New Covent Garden in their office rather than a can of something. That was a bit naff. You didn't bring a can into the office.
So that, in a way, was a little bit of luck, in that you thought this is for people who are doing dinner parties and maybe having that as a starter, and they haven't quite got time to cook their own, and it's an upmarket sort of purchase, so to speak, you know, a bit of a luxury purchase. And then, of course, people are going, more and more microwaves in offices, aren't there, as well, I think, as you know, that's quite helpful. Yep. All of a sudden, people are buying it for lunch as well.
Well, it began being an upmarket purchase, I guess, but pretty quickly, people found the convenience and the quality of the product meant that it appealed to everybody. And everybody works, typically, and works in a busy environment. And this was, again, don't forget, this was way back in 1987, when Pret was just starting off. And you didn't have Yo Sushi, you didn't have Eat, you didn't have a whole bunch, the plethora of high street,
so many
fresh
options,
quality, convenient.
It just was sandwiches, wasn't it? That was your option,
much.
Really.
Yeah. And so soup was, you know, if you wanted to have bread with it, you could. If you didn't, you didn't have to. And it was perceived to be healthier, certainly more convenient, and tasted great.
And
what
hot
was your,
as well.
Yeah,
and that's a big player for, you know, if you want
especially
a hot meal.
Winter.
Exactly.
If you wanted
a
warming lunch, I mean, soup sales, it's very, very seasonal. You can almost set your watch by what happens in the first week.
In October.
September even.
Is it? All right.
Kids go back to school, people put their barbecues away, even if it's a warm September.
Yeah.
Soup sales rise dramatically right through till January, hold, and then they disappear again around May.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it makes a lot of sense, really.
So what was the first one that you decided to do? So right, we're going to make soup. Did you take on the tomato soup people, or was you going, no, we're going to go chicken, we're going to do? What was your first?
That's a very good question.
Although I'm worried about you, John, because I don't think you had a huge amount of thinking process listening to how you started off. But in terms of,
I mean, some of this was conscious, some of this was a bit of luck too, and you need a bit of luck. But you know, it's all about consumer insight. But once you figure out what the consumer really wants, then and you pay attention to that, then you can tailor make your offering. We start off with three products: carrot and coriander.
Vichy
Soise, which is leek and potato. And we had a chicken with lemon and tarragon. All three were delicious, but they weren't necessarily what you might assume. It wasn't like minestrone and oxtail and cream of tomato that you the mainstay of the can category. But we did that on purpose because we didn't want to be competing. We had no intention of competing with the canned category. We wanted to generate something new and
different.
It was much more suitable to the fresh, convenient, chilled location where we're going to place this.
I mean, you actually were a very early disruptor in a term that's used now that definitely wasn't used then, but you actually really genuinely disrupted the market.
In hindsight, again, yeah, we did.
that was the plan all along.
John, I'm looking at you to be a guru for me, you know, in terms of the but as you say, it's a combination of the two things, isn't it? It's luck and spotting a really genuine gap.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely wanted to do something different, and we knew it was going to be an uphill battle, and we knew there were going to be lots of reasons where people would say no and not believe it and find other reasons to keep the status quo. You know, I often say, you know, don't put an awful lot of faith in conventional wisdom, because it's more often an awful lot more convention than it is wisdom. And I think, you know, easy to say that. Because you're going to get a lot of no's and kickbacks and refusals. And a lot of time, those no's and refusals are inside your own head. So you've got to get over that first. And then you've got to basically be passionate about what you're doing and make sure you are communicating exactly the benefits of your product to the consumer and making sure the retailer understands that and your investors and your employees and everybody needs to really understand what you're trying to achieve here and you bring it all together. And hopefully it'll work out.
That really disruptive element that you talk about, John, is very interesting for me because I'm a hometown boy from King's Lynn in Norfolk, which is where Campbell Soups were once, and they've disappeared. And you can kind of see that whole thing of them.
That was a huge manufacturer at one time, wasn't it?
It was massive. Yeah. I think it employed close to 500 people in the town. Wow. But it's completely gone.
Well, please don't blame me, I'm sure.
And that's all down to John Stapleton. If anybody would like to write in, John's your
chat. You've got any hate mail.
However, it's now turned to a Tesco Extra store, which is
where you can buy plenty of Campbell Soup.
Almost equivalent in terms of employment, but also as the market has changed, it's kind of become one of those things that people have seen, as you refer to, it becoming that first course or that lunchtime break. Mm. It's something that even I remember using or buying when you first went live, I think in Tesco in about 1991, throughout the UK, of being there on the first day that your soup was actually on the shelves and taking all three of those ingredients home.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. You mentioned Campbell's and of course, Campbell's and Heinz and Baxter's all came into the market in the early 90s. And we were literally shaking in our boots at that stage. We thought we've wakened the beast. You know, we've invented fresh soup and we brought it to the market and some people like it. And now the professionals are going to come in and swat us away. And we were kind of bracing ourselves. But actually what happened, they came in and then left again because they were all, you know, large organizations, very used to dealing in the ambient sector with long shelf lives.
And different, and completely different market.
And had perfected that side of their business. Mm. And then they were dabbling in fresh and chilled and the ingredients and the sourcing and the supply chain involved with 14 days was unheard of for them. Yeah. And they left after a season of spending quite a lot of money, by the way, generating awareness for their brand.
Which you then capitalised.
That's helping you, isn't it?
For fresh soup. Yeah, so a lot of people talking about fresh soup and so they left and we were left with the market.
So thanks, chaps. You spent all that marketing money helping us raise the profile of the category. So Covent Garden Soup, new Covent Garden Soup Company, started growing. You deliberately went for supermarket listings, did you? Was that the first tactic?
Absolutely. Our intention was to build a national brand, and you cannot build a national brand without going sooner or later to the major multiples. And there were more then than there are now. So obviously consolidation has taken place, but there were big five or six, and we wanted to get them. We also decided to manufacture. We had to manufacture ourselves because nobody made fresh soup. We couldn't outsource the manufacture of fresh soup. You want to go to a manufacturer then and say, I want to make some soup. They go, okay, how big do you want the can to be? We go, well, actually, we're thinking of something different. So that was a non-starter, that conversation. So we had to build a factory. We had to design a process. We actually patented our process. It was all quite a long-winded process. Because nobody did it before. And, you know, we were told we were crazy, by the way, by the experts, by many people.
So how did you find the money to do that, John? Yeah. Did you just grow organically and gradually afforded stuff and then took stuff on as you went along, or did you start off with a big cash injection?
Unfortunately wasn't possible to grow organically because you either have to do it or not do it, and we were not in a position to, you know, manufacture a little bit and sell it through some independents and then grow from there, because you have to have either you have to have a factory or don't have a factory.
So it's all or nothing. Really.
Pretty much. And the lots of requirements in terms of making it safe. This was one of the big red flags. You know, the whole point of canned soup was safe and long shelf life and stable. That's why all that stuff is in a can. Soup has all of the risks associated with all of the food elements you could possibly think of. It's got liquids and it's got spices and it's got fish and it's got all, so all of the risks go in there. So you have to make sure it's safe. So we had to design this process, build this factory and implement it to the levels that were going to be, you know, the standards required by the FSA, but also the retailers and, of course, to protect the consumer. So we raised a lot of money to do that. And
that's a huge leap of faith. Yeah. Did you really, really believe that it was going to take off? Because it was different. And I mean, it's a massive leap of faith. You've got to convince as well investors. You've got to do an amazing pitch that they're gonna hold hands with you and jump over the cliff edge with you. And then that's a huge amount of belief.
Yeah, it is. But you know, we were young and naive at the time, so it's easy to have belief.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. I mean, you got to convince yourself. We were convinced, and Andrew was certainly convinced, and he convinced me, and we convinced everybody else, and we managed to convince the consumer, convince the retailer, convince investors, and then form a team around us to and convince them too. And that was really important. But we did that based on, we weren't quite sure how long it was going to take to be able to capture the market.
Yeah.
And we weren't quite sure how quickly others would catch up with us or compete with us. And like I explained earlier, luckily they came in and left again. Of course, what then happened was the retailers themselves developed their own label versions, which competed with us. But frankly, once you've got the advantage of the first mover, and once you've got the premium position, you can maintain that, and you can defend that. And actually, the own label category comes in slightly beneath the brand, typically, if you're doing your work properly.
In terms of price, you mean?
In terms of price and quality and the entire proposition and the entire offer.
And the way it looks.
And then together you can grow the category much more quickly than you would if you were on your own.
Yeah.
And in fact, the own label presence in that category gives the new category credibility to the consumer. They see it's not just these weird guys in cartons. It's Tesco's are doing it, and Waitrose are doing it, everybody else is doing it. So we all benefited from that. We had the advantage of the first 2-3 years of being on our own, making lots and lots and lots of mistakes. Luckily, in hindsight, again, none of them terminal, but we got away with a lot because we were the only fresh soup manufacturer. And once we eventually figured out what we needed to do right and perfected it, both as a manufacturing business, but as a brand building business, then we were on the right track. And that's when we attracted most of the competition, but we were ready for it, luckily.
And then when competition comes along, you can fight it out in lots of ways, can't you? You can start having a price war, or you can innovate so they're catching up with you. That's the other sort of tactic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's death to the category if you go straight into a price war. It's just a race to the bottom.
Too. Yeah. Mm.
And I guess later in the evolution of New Covent Garden, luckily after we had sold it already, but that began to happen, and lots of promotions in the category and a lot more competition, competition on price. In the early years, we had the opportunity to, we had this big factory which was empty, so we had to
Let's experiment.
Yeah, exactly. we had to go and fill it, right? Yeah. And the best way to fill it is to make lots of soup, and lots of different types of soup. By the way, if you want to build a brand, in my estimation, in the UK or anywhere for that matter, you have to invest ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
You have to be able to invest and generate awareness for your brand, and you don't usually generate that sort of cash or those resources from the business. So you really have to bring in shareholders' funds to invest in building the brand. And that's what we did later with Little Dish, because we outsourced manufacturing there. But back to New Covent Garden, we had to manufacture ourselves, like I explained. We spent all the money we raised on building a very good, high-tech, sophisticated factory. No money left then to build the brand, so that was a bit of a problem for us.
Nice shiny boys' toys over there.
We had all that.
We're all in a bit of a cardboard packaging.
That is always such a problem with getting the balance right. It's like do you go and build the audience first and then find out what product you're going to sell them, or do you make the product and then hope to attract the audience if you've got any money left? Very challenging to get the timing right.
Ideally, you got resources to build a national brand by generating awareness for your brand. So you get it on the shelf, and then you work really hard at getting it off the shelf. You get basically a retailer that will back you. So put it on that shelf, and then you generate a lot of buzz around and awareness for that presence on shelf. And then if the product is good, once the consumer buys it, they'll come back and buy it again. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry too much about repeat purchase. You've got to worry about the first purchase. But that costs a lot of money, and it costs a lot of effort and resources. And we had spent it all being a factory. So all we could do then really was make lots of new types of products. In other words, NPD. Yeah. And then get a lot of PR for the NPD. So all we could do literally was NPD and PR. So we did that because we had the ability to do it. And it was all about fresh soup. And people were thinking, those two words don't go together, fresh and soup. So instantly you had an opportunity to talk about it because people were interested to know what it was, or they were saying that doesn't make sense. So you had an opportunity to explain yourself.
Absolutely.
And bringing in new products then allowed you to talk even more about fresh soup.
And actually you then had quite a lot of combinations that you wouldn't have found in tin soup. You know, that you sort of, in terms of your brand development, your product development. And again, that's something that people can talk about, isn't it? Because you started bringing you know, combinations of sort of ingredients that you might well do at home from a cookery book, but you would never find in a tin soup.
Well, that's exactly right. And that gave us a great breadth of opportunity to do all sorts of weird and wonderful things. Not just do them, but talk about them. And I remember one particular example. We made a number of different things. We tried gazpacho and we tried fishy swaz, which is actually leek and potato soup in the summertime, just a slightly thinner version. But we made a borscht soup once. I think, Adam, I'm hopeless on dates.
Beetroot.
Exactly.
It's an old traditional
Ukrainian originally recipe. And we had a Ukrainian girl working in the factory, and she came up with her grandmother's recipe, and this is all true. And we said, well, why don't we try doing this? And it tasted very interesting.
very now, don't diplomatic.
Don't forget, 1993, 92, 91, something like that. Now, these days, you find beetroot everywhere.
Beetroot's on trend now, but it wasn't then.
beetroot juice. In fact, just beetroot. Beetroot people are drinking. But back then, it was a bit of a struggle. But anyway, we launched it and we got a huge amount of PR out of this crazy idea. First of all, what is borscht and the story behind that?
This bright purple soup.
Why are we making it and where is it listed? And we got column inches left, right and centre and we talked about it and it was great. But all this while we were talking about fresh soup.
But did you actually sell any?
No.
I was going to say that.
Bomb.
That's fine. It's okay. It's a marketing tactic.
Exactly. Well,
what's the absolute worst one that you've ever done? It hasn't maybe seen the light of day when you were there. What the worst that you tasted and gone, oh, that is the worst thing we've ever done?
Well, I mean, that was the worst one commercially.
Oh, was it?
Without a shadow of a doubt. But from a PR perspective, it was fantastic.
Yeah.
In terms of launching. But there are lots of products that, we behind the scenes, you will develop and you think, for lots of reasons, either they're too expensive or they're too esoteric or just taste rubbish.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So the company's then growing and growing. Did you get bored to a certain extent, or did you think, I really need somebody else to come along and take it the next step? Or what was the decision to sell? Because you actually were there for quite a long time.
10 years. Yeah. 87 to 98 we sold. And I guess the first thing to say is it was always our intention to sell. We built the business like we build, all the business I've been involved in. There's been an exit plan. It's typically taken longer than we thought, but there's been an exit plan.
But otherwise, you're just creating yourself a job. The idea is build a business you've built a product to sell.
Yeah, and a lifestyle business, there's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. Mm. If you want to build a business and not necessarily build a national brand and have it in limited distribution and maybe some food service and build it over years and take a salary out of it and hand it on to your kids, what's wrong with that?
Mm, yeah.
That wasn't our plan. We wanted to build something and then sell it to an interested party, whether it be trade or private equity or whatever, that wasn't determined at the time. So we always were going to do that. The question was just when. And it took us 10 years when I guess we originally thought it'd be 5 or 6. But that's, again, the benefit of naivety for you. But it was the right time.
That's easier, though, John, isn't it, to get investment when you've got a very clear exit strategy and the investors know that actually you're going to be selling it. And so, therefore, they're investing because they can see the end game.
Well, exactly.
And they're not so worried about putting their money in because they know it's going to come out. So you reach.
You need to get all stakeholders aligned.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Of course, you need to have a good product that there's going to be demand for. Of course, you need to have your branding sorted. Of course, all these elements of a business plan, management team knows what they're doing most of the time. You have all these things that are important. But you need to have a plan that says, well, if I'm going to invest £1.2 million, for example, to build this wonderful factory, when do I get my money back? When do I get my return? So
You can't really say, I'm terribly sorry, I haven't really thought about that yet. You're not going to get the money, are you? If that's your answer.
No.
You've got to have a plan. And even if you don't quite make the timescales, you've got a very clear vision of exactly how
where you're going.
Work. Yeah.
Yeah, nobody makes timescales. I think everybody realises that that's the case. But so long as you have a plan that seems realistic and you can buy into, and we'll amend it as we go along. By the way, if you ever hit your objectives on time, it's always for completely different reasons than you originally thought.
Yeah, by mistake.
Yeah, yeah. but there is a plan, and you can buy into it, and it seems reasonable. And then if everybody's aligned behind that, once you get around to the point of, well, now is the time to sell, one party says, then it's probably is the time to sell because everybody is in agreement.
Yeah. So just skating over some other bits in your sort of history, really. You sold that, and then you sort of did a little venture in America. But then you came across Little Dish, which is your current sort of company.
Yeah.
Why go into that? So that's children's meals. That feels quite different, or did it seem quite similar to you?
That's a very interesting question. And now we're rolling back to 2004 or so. Yeah. And the intervening years, sold New Covent Garden in 98, went to the States, did Glencoe Foods, came back, lived in now Munich, because my wife's German. We've been living there since we came back from the States, so 2003. And I've been looking at what's been happening in the UK, 2003, 4, 5, for a while. And this was around about the time when Jamie Oliver was on his first crusade, if you like. Yeah. He was making a lot of noise about the state and the nation's health, particular kids' diets, particular school dinners.
So you were actively looking for something at that
point? I was spending some time in the UK, mostly in London, looking at various small business opportunities and helping people with ideas and projects and concepts. And so I was, yeah, absolutely looking to see what I was going to do next without any particular agenda at all. And we don't have kids ourselves, so it was maybe unusual that we'd be, you know, drawn into that particular category. But I was looking at a number of projects in that space, and then I met Hillary, who was doing something similar from a different angle, and we both had the same kind of niggling feeling, if you like. There's got to be an opportunity here. We're not sure what form it's going to be in. So, and we met by serendipity, as usually is the case. And over a period of time, we kind of compared notes and kept in contact. And then again, long story short, we decided to go and do it. But I think the timing was very interesting, because getting back to Jamie, you know, you'd have people sitting in pubs having conversation with each other, didn't have kids themselves, talking about kids' food. So it was very, very topical. And the health movement was in its infancy, but it was there. And mothers were concerned about being able to provide the best for their kids and not having the time to cook from scratch, because they were thinking that they were being told that's the best way to do it.
And again, the choices then would be Heinz in a jar, wouldn't it? If you're out and about with your child and having to take the lid off that and then shoving it down the poor kid's throat.
That's right.
There wasn't much around, was there, in terms of children's...
I don't want to bash on Heinz twice in a row from some point of view.
I was going to say, you've taken on the same people, just with a different product at each level.
So we now understand, actually, I'm just going to get Heinz. I know, I'll tack them over baby food now.
Well, there are a number of brands there, of course. And you know, Heinz was one and Hip was another. And there's a lot of our own label there as well. But basically, and it's all organic when you get from a baby's point of view. And then once you get out of baby, which is over 12 months, then it becomes a kind of a free-for-all. And nothing really existed from a quality point of view. And we did some research. We did some market research. And one comment I really sticks in my mind to this day was, it was kind of almost like aghast, a mom. We had a bunch of moms around the table doing some market research. And, oh, my God, this food is older than my baby.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, that
really
is wonderful.
Home.
Let's take that and do something with that.
That's really a soundbite, isn't it?
So when you think about it, it's an 18-month shelf life for a can of, or a little jar
made that
of.
In a factory before I even gave birth to my child.
There you go. There you go. And there's nothing wrong with this from a
safety point of view.
Absolutely. Do you really want to do that? So the alternative is make it yourself. Except then we came along and we said, look, we'll take all the hassle away from, if you want to make it yourself, do, and that's the best approach. But we can do it instead. And we do a pretty good job on it. Leave it to us. Trust us. We'll do all the right sourcing of all the ingredients. We make sure it's clean. We make sure it's fresh. We make sure it's very healthy and the right nutritional balance. And we put it all together for you. All you need to do is buy it and, you know, prepare it in the kitchen very quickly for your child.
And of course, somebody once said to me that successful people make success look really easy. So, John Stapleton, you've now reached 200,000 youngsters every week with this, and your turnover has passed 12 million. You're pretty good at this, aren't you?
Now he knows what he's doing, because he's been up the mountain a couple of times.
Absolutely.
You know, it does get a little easier. I mean, some things get more tricky, definitely. Yeah, I do know a little bit more about the food industry now than I did when I started off 30 years ago. So that gives you a little bit more confidence. And some things work and some things just don't work. So I think, you know, experience is, you know, goes for a lot, sure.
Absolutely.
I told you it's a grown-up program this week.
Yeah, well, I'm learning a lot as well, which is fantastic.
Well, we're going to have a little break now, and really looking forward to talking to Steve and May of Smarter Applications. And we'll come back to you again as well, John. So thank you very much for that. We're just going to have a little break and just have a couple of sound bites from when we went to the Speciality and Fine Food Fair. See you in a minute. So I'm at Speciality and Fine Food Fair along with Guy Routledge, and there's loads and loads of chocolate makers here. I think tea I'm seeing as a theme, chocolate is another theme, food as health another theme.
all sorts of really tasty, delicious, amazing things. There is a chocolate fair that is part of the event today as well. We have a lovely guest who's joined us with some chocolate.
But the thing with the chocolate is some of it is a bit samey, you know, whatever. Some of it is amazingly almost like sculptures. I mean, real high end, you know, this. I'm joined by Adam here of Adam's Organic Cold Pressed Chocolate. What is cold pressed?
Well, it's a raw chocolate. So the beans are fermented rather than your traditional roasting methods. So ours are unroasted, fermented. And then they're cold. They're put into like a large pestle and mortar, and they grind it down into this lovely paste. And then it's cold pressed, and then we work with the paste as blocks.
So most people then will get a cocoa bean, and then, as you say, they will roast it. You'll get the sort of the cocoa butter that comes out, but then the sort of the liquid that comes out is what's used in the cocoa. You know, in the chocolate making process, but you don't roast it. What you're saying is, do you just like squash it?
No, so our beans are unroasted, so it just retains all the sort of natural antioxidants and high in sort of all your nutrients. But the actual process is we use a paste, but we also use the fat as well. So when the bean is grinded down, is obviously the fat that's extracted. So we use both parts of the bean and the nibs and the powder to make up our recipes.
So you literally use the whole of the cocoa pod, whereas everybody else is separating stuff out?
Well, a lot of people use it. The traditional methods are roasting the beans, and then there's a conching process and another process after that. But we use actually more raw sort of cold-pressed techniques.
Well, I'd better try some then, just to see, don't you think?
I think we better have try some. But so the term that I've heard with cold-pressed is cold-pressed juice. Yep. Where, and is this a very similar kind of process, or is it just because you're trying to... compare it to like that rawness where there's no cooking, there's no roasting, there's no pasteurizing or anything?
Yeah, exactly. It's just a process of cold pressed. I'm fonder of this kind of angle of like cold pressed is I feel more comfortable with than raw.
Also, for me, you've got to retain more of the nutrients, haven't you, when it's cold pressed?
Yeah, well, obviously the roasting process changes the molecular structure of the cooking process changes the molecular structure of all foods. So this process obviously retains a lot of the benefits that you get from cacao. And cacao is an amazing plant, whether it's roasted or unroasted. But our recipes don't have, they're free from dairy, gluten, soy and refined sugars.
So you're opening a packet here. Now you've got what one's that one? You've got goji berry and pistachio.
Yep, that's most probably one of our more popular ones. The goji berry is a Chinese berry. They've been used in sort of Chinese medicine for thousands of years. It's very high in vitamin C and antioxidants. And pistachio, I think we're all pretty familiar with that one.
It's almost got the consistency of fudge.
Yeah, it even comes out in like a little cube, which I was, I was really interested to know what this would look like, because normally chocolates they're either these like individual truffly things or what have you, or you've got a block of chocolate. But this is, I guess, it was originally a block, was it?
Well, the idea behind the cubes are more it's a sharing pack. So I feel chocolate should be shared, you know. So we've got these little 8 pieces in this. In this pouch, which is resealable, and you can share them around the office, or you can, you know, eat them to yourself and enjoy them.
Not sharing them around our office, I can tell you that now, Adam.
But the fudge-like texture that you're referring to is actually the natural sweetener we use is responsible for that. It's something called yacon, which, have you heard of that?
No, I haven't.
So it's a Peruvian sweet potato. So it's like the texture of a radish. And that's cold pressed into this lovely thick syrup, which we add to our chocolate that gives it this lovely fudge-like texture.
And I can also see here that you're using Criollo, which is one of the best beans to use for chocolate, in my personal opinion.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of it. It's a lovely, lovely bean. We use from Satipo in Peru. It's regarded as a king of cacao beans, so yeah.
Definitely agree with that.
So it's a species, is it? Sorry, yeah. I'm not familiar with this particular bean. Is it?
There's two. Trinisteria is the other one, just trying to remember. And Criollo are probably but most people say that Criollo is the best bean. It's got the best flavour profile.
Yeah, it's very delicate, and if you were to roast it, it's very delicate. So a lot of farmers, it's very prone to infestations, and it's... it's not really widely used in the chocolate industry. I think it's only around 5% of sort of chocolatiers use it.
A bit temperamental and a bit expensive, that's why. So you must be travelling all over the place in order to do all this, or do you just sit at home interneting? I doubt it. You're obviously going to the Andes and doing all sorts of things to source this stuff.
Well, all our sourcing, we actually source it in the UK, but I've been making the chocolate for about 13 years now, a bit longer. So it sort of started with me sort of almost changing my diet and exploring a sort of a healthier raw vegan diet. And I was actually just eating cacao on its own because it's got so many benefits to the body. And after time, I just started to develop different sort of cooking techniques and making nice desserts and then move me on to these sorts of recipes that we're enjoying now.
So you haven't travelled out there? You've just done loads and loads of research?
No, not to that part of the world, no. It sort of started in my kitchen in Wye Valley. And
there's nothing wrong with that.
So did you end up having to build your own like machinery to do this cold pressing of the chocolate in your kitchen? Or have you managed to kind of get it out into it? Or did you find a manufacturer who could help you with this new and interesting process?
So the process has been used for thousands of years. I've just been working with a company in the UK that source it from Peru. So we're actually buying it from a supplier in the UK, all our various superfoods, all from South America. And I've just been experimenting with various ones for many years and sort of to make up these recipes.
Well, something very different, I think. But it's got a very, I'm trying to explain it, it's probably more tart and more earthy than most chocolate I've tasted. Would you say that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not what it is familiar to me as chocolate, you know, as a sweet bar that you would have or even cook with it, I guess, because this has got the flavouring in there already, so you probably wouldn't put it into something else. You would eat it by itself.
No, that's right. These recipes are already made up. But, I mean, cacao, before I add the, you know, the nibs and the powder, it can be used, you know, as a almost like a savoury spice. You could sprinkle these nibs over your eggs, and that would, you know, be a nice way to introduce cacao into your diet. Cacao is an incredible plant, whether it's, you know, roasted or unroasted.
Well, that's perfect. So where can we get this from, Adam?
We're available through diverse fine foods, but this particular pouch here is our launch. We just launched this sort of today or over this weekend, but the company's been going for 18 months or so, and we've been available in health food and farm shops in the southwest in Bristol.
Southwest. I thought I could take that slight southwest.
There's a small twang.
Lovely,
there.
Small twang. Yeah, brilliant. So good luck with it.
Yeah, fantastic product, really, and good luck with the rest of the show.
Okay, thank you very much.
There we go. That's some stuff from Speciality and Fine Food Fair. So we were talking to John Stapleton about his journey through New Covent Garden Soup Company and more recently about his children's meals, which are from Little Dish. And if you're interested in Little Dish, you need to go to littledish.co.uk. Stephen, you've just been sitting there listening away to John. You were an early adopter. I think you're allowed to say that, aren't you? An early adopter of soup, weren't you, from the New Covent Garden Soup Company?
It's one of those moments where you realise that the grey hair on your head doesn't kind of disguise the fact that you're no longer young and you've kind of been on a long 25 plus year journey in a parallel industry. Yeah. However, you've been a consumer of a product that you absolutely love. So I'm kind of privileged to be sat here.
There you go.
Great stuff.
Now, you're doing some real product innovation, not so much in terms of the food product itself, but actually these very sort of stylish, groundbreaking connected products. Do you like using the term Internet of Things? How do you describe it? Or do you not like that? It's gone out of fashion now.
It's an odd one. When you see those three letters, IoT, and it's like, okay, what does that actually mean? It's like, yeah. It's kind of smart home, smart tech area. But the kind of key element for me is just stepping back for that all the time and trying to look at it as a consumer. The very first products that you kind of connect with the internet, whether it be your computer that you suddenly disconnected from the cable, whether it's your phone that suddenly didn't have a cable connected to the wall, it all kind of moves forwards and is a kind of long, continuous journey.
So when I was a child, I can't remember, somebody in my family, some auntie or something, had a teas made. So what I used to do,
my
do you remember
and dad
them?
Used to have
they're
one
really
of those as
old.
Well.
Like, they're like sort of having, you know, hostess trolley in the 70s, you know, so that sort of thing. And I seem to recall that a tea's made, you put the water in.
A goblin tea's made. That's the one.
You put the water in, didn't you? And then it was plugged into the wall. And then was there just a timer on it? I can't remember.
There was a kettle and a brewing pot.
Right.
And a light. And a few other bits and bobs that were attached to various different models.
They didn't really take off, did they? I don't think.
Well, they had a huge penetration in terms of where they reached. And for me, that's one of those products that you look back at the history of the category of making your tea and or coffee and see that really was the first step to put it literally on the bedside table.
It was, wasn't it? You're supposed to have it next to your bed.
Yeah,
but people didn't have phones and all that sort of stuff then. They didn't even have Covent Garden Soup Company.
that is true. But you don't really need a phone to make a cup of tea. So you can now, which I guess is the interesting thing.
And then you've developed the iKettle, which you can control via Wi-Fi. Is that the same sort of thing? But it's just you've arrived 30 years later and updated it?
Absolutely. It's very similar, but it kind of does a whole bunch of different things that you would want to do if you knew you could. Mm. And adding them into a wireless chip and making your smart kettle smart and do the things you want to, like waking up in the morning, setting the alarm, but the kettle boils before the alarm goes off. So the alarm goes off, you walk downstairs and it's ready to pour. That might have been at 100 degrees, or if you wanted it at 80 for specialist tea or a different temperature for specialist teas, you can get it exactly at that temperature. It can keep it warm if you want to maintain it at that temperature, or equally, and the bit which I love, is just driving home, walking through the front door, click, the kettle's boiled, and if you like instant coffee or tea at the right temperature, you could just pour it straight out.
And have you had much success with the iKettle?
There are hundreds of thousands of units already out. There've been three. Wow. This is the third generation of the product. We've improved it considerably along that journey. But one of the kind of key benefits of the product, which kind of links exactly to the area that John's in at the moment, is kind of that movement from formula milk for babies. So we have a feature on the product, which is our formula mode, where you can boil the kettle and it will tell you when it's at 60 degrees or your particular required temperature to make formula milk to feed your child. So for dads,
so
for those,
more control.
Now that's really interesting. Yeah.
For those who are up late at night or get woken up late at night, you can even, using something called If This Then That, you can actually link a baby monitor or alarm that tells you the baby's woken up and it will then boil the kettle.
That is pretty smart stuff. So I was looking into this earlier today.
I just
used to
let my baby cry, but anyway.
Some excellent parenting tips
You know
Sue
how
there.
Good I am at parenting.
It's brilliant. Mm. I was looking at the website earlier today, and the product, it's the physical product, the kettle, is beautiful. It looks really slick. It's the kind of thing that I can picture on my bench. But I was just thinking, but it does all this stuff. But do I really need a kettle that does all that? But it's when you kind of listen to somebody explain it and say, well, you could use it this way or that way or the other, then you can actually almost see yourself saying, yeah, that does make sense. That is a useful thing.
Alluding to something John said right at the beginning, which was it's the PR about it. It's getting the message out. It's having the conversation. It's telling people. And then it's people that buy the product actually recommending it or talking about it to their friends and families.
And they will probably tell the story of why it's worth having. They'll say, you should get this kettle because it does this thing.
And my little side story was I walked into a Mama's and Papa's store in Milton Keynes a few weeks ago. Didn't have a product. We just walked in and thought, I wonder if this is the sort of place that could sell this product. There were 7 products that they had for making baby formula milk, all of which were over £100, and none of which actually boiled the water.
And so it was one of those. It must be a market.
It's one of those moments where the store manager went, "What? That product actually exists?
Yeah.
Can you get in contact with our head of retailing and tell them that this exists? Because we would sell," and that was the conversation.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah. That's very good. And is it the sort of thing you would use, John? Are you a gadget man? Do you like gadgets?
Yeah, I've got lots of gadgets, but the problem is I'm not sure how many of them work. I probably use about 10% of the smartphone
capability.
Functionality. I still use it for telephoning, believe it or not.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I love gadgets.
Nobody else does.
I'm not sure
they've got to be useful, yeah. And I know you've got a coffee machine as well, which works very much like the kettle. But I think the thing that you're hitting the headlines with the most at the moment, particularly I saw some stuff in The Guardian, is the fridge cam. And food waste is exercising lots of people at the moment, isn't it?
Absolutely. So for me, one of the kind of the key pivotal things, we did two events earlier on in July, was Christmas in July with both Currys and with Amazon. And the boards at both of those events highlighted the fridge cam as their tipped product for Christmas, really? Which is a wonderful endorsement for a company that was at startup phase 3 years ago, has two products in the market, and is now bringing their third to market. So for us, that was really, really a recognition of the hard work and the effort that got in, that the two companies in the tech space for consumer actually said, we believe in this, we can see there's an opportunity, and we want to get behind it.
So what does it do?
Yeah.
To give a bit of context around this fridge cam.
So really simply, you'd put the product onto the fridge door, so it's looking inwards into your fridge, and as you set it up, you clear the contents of your fridge first, because then that way it can link to everything that's inside. You then you can scan the products that go into your fridge by using your mobile phone to connect those two pieces
just
together.
On the barcode.
Yeah, so from the barcode, it will then be able to recognize the product. We then use some recognize and remember data that we work with the supermarkets on, so that we can actually have you take the barcode photograph, it can then recognize what that product is inside the fridge. And it learns, so it can be specific to each individual person. What then happens is each time you close the door, as you get to a certain angle, which you set up before, it photographs what's in the fridge, and you then receive that directly to your phone. So each time you access the phone inside the app, then it can show you exactly what's in your fridge right now.
As a list or as a photo?
As a photograph.
Okay, wow.
And then what you also have, and these kind of like five or six different pieces come in together. One is that you've got the products in, it knows what date they went in. So you can tell it what the expiries are on those individual products, and it will start effectively a countdown timer. So if you imagine when you put tomatoes in, for example, you might have 9 days from when you buy them to when they're out of their best before date. That countdown timer starts. So you've got multiple countdown timers all ticking away at the same time inside the app. Then 2 days before it's due to go beyond its best before date, it will flag that this product is close to its expiry date. And then, which is the really smart part of the smarter app, it will tell you, based on what you've got in your fridge, this is what you can cook.
Oh, now that is a nice feature. Yeah. I have literally just done this week. Manually, I went to my fridge and my store cupboard and my other store cupboard and my other store cupboard just to like take a mental note of everything to try and piece together a meal plan for the rest of the week, because I've got all sorts of stuff there that just isn't being used up. And it didn't take that long, but I had to, you know, catalogue it manually and then try and come up with recipes myself. So that is genius.
Do you know what? Sometimes I worry about you. If you've got nothing else to do,
I'm incredibly busy.
How long did that take you?
I only spent about 15 minutes on it.
15 hours doing
15,
it?
No, 15 minutes.
All right,
no,
just but I think that's the point, isn't it? It sounds like a chore, and therefore you never do it.
And that's why you put it off for so long.
You don't have to think about any of that. It does it for you.
Yeah.
One of the amazing parts about the product, and having kind of worked with this during its development cycle, is really that in the beginning when you look at the product, it's a fridge cam. It takes a picture of the inside of your fridge. But then what it does in terms of its software and how it interacts with you. So imagine if I were to say, make this big, broad statement, it's kind of like Facebook for a fridge. Because at the moment, every day, the average consumer opens and closes that fridge 20 times. And it's got the latest up-to-date piece of information on it. But now you know, like Facebook, who's in, who's out, who's with who, who's not with who, who's going out of date, and who you're going to delete from your friends list.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what it also does is takes that information on your expired product, so the expiry date's the best before tracker, and it looks at, have you used that product? And if you have online shopping, it can push that purchase directly to your next order. So you can either drip feed by carrier bag load, or you can put it into your weekly shop. So it can directly replace the contents that are in your fridge so that you can use them. Now, there's an element of seasonality which comes into that, which maybe, for example,
because let's face it, you know, we all sort of buy stuff in a supermarket or a local shop or whatever. And in my head, I think because I'm getting a bit older, I think sometimes I think, oh, I don't have any of that. And when I get home, I have. You know, and actually, or I've got a particular obsession, like with coconut milk. I don't know why I have an obsession with coconut milk. But for some reason, I always have 6 cans in the cupboard, which I don't need 6 cans. I only need 2. But I always, when I go to the supermarket, I don't think I've got any. I don't know.
I'll just get some just in case.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And but so what you're saying is that we all have perceptions of what we use and the level of which we use it, or we overstock things and understock others. So instead of relying on that sort of perception, which is not often true, this is actually beginning to help you to learn what you really do use and what you really buy, but actually consistently waste. And it's actually helping you understand your own consumption.
Well, the average consumer in the UK will throw away circa £720 worth of sealed goods that they purchased.
Do you have any data on what the most likely thing to be thrown out is based on the fridge cam?
In a kitchen at the moment, from our data that we did in February, 34% is bread.
Yeah.
28% is sealed vegetable. And that may be sealed salad, for example.
Oh, wow.
How long do the little dish products last for? And I presume that with baby food, with toddler's food, actually that doesn't get wasted quite as much, I'm thinking.
Gets wasted at all, yeah. I mean, it's kind of similar to fresh soup. We had a couple of weeks from manufacturer, and then it runs through the supply chain, and the consumer buys it typically with a week.
Yeah,
maybe 10 days. And that's important because they've got the two weekends as well included in that. Depends how frequently consumers purchase. And, you know, these days people are going to the supermarket more frequently than maybe, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Mm. Yeah. So how's this fridge cam doing? I mean, I know it's about £100, isn't it, to buy?
Absolutely. So we're due to launch at the International Funkerstellung exhibition over in Berlin on the 31st of this month. And kind of just going from the pre-work that we've done, it will be available in Currys from the 26th of October and on Amazon. And then over in the US, we already have it placed in Best Buy and MediaMarkt in Germany and various other retailers there in France, in Fnac and Boulanger and Darty. So it's got immediate penetration.
Yeah.
But the key with the product really for us from a kind of understanding the sales perspective is engaging with the people that are in those stores in the way of the sales teams and actually teaching them the art of attachment selling, which is we know that circa 10 million fridges are sold across the UK in any individual year. We know that's heading towards a 10-year cycle on replacing our fridges, and it's about offering this product with every fridge that's sold in a retailer. And then the standalone side. So sold alone part of the business is obviously going to be a growth curve because it can retrofit into any single fridge. It doesn't have to be brand specific. But more importantly, based on the earnings of an individual person or household income, then the lower the household income, the greater the percentage of wastage food. And it's pretty staggering when you look at £720 at the lowest level of income.
It's such a huge dent. Yeah. And we were talking to John about how he sort of scaled up and sort of launched a factory and sort of went for it. So it's either this big expenditure or not. You're talking about making, you know, machines here and equipment. How have you managed to? Because presumably you can't just knock up a couple in your garage and then go to, you know, Currys and try and sell them. You've presumably had to get investors and go big immediately as well.
You kind of have to stand back and kind of look around the world and look for the largest manufacturer partners of electronics and head in that direction. What you also then need to do is kind of prepare for the whole engagement process, because the engagement process with the teams that sell your product is more important. It's quite easy in the supermarket world. It's a standalone product that has to be self-service, so there's advertising, promotion, there's all the brand investment that John spoke about earlier. But for us, our investment is much more in the people that talk to customers, because you can buy a £200 fridge, a £300 fridge, a £400 fridge,
or a £5,000 fridge,
and it doesn't matter how much you spend, you can still save the same amount of money. And that's the key driver. So for us, the investment that goes in is finding the right manufacturer partners, developing the robust manufacturing processes that sit, and it's kind of aligned to everything that John said about building your own factory in the beginning. It's the processes, it's the team, and it's the engagement throughout the supply chain. What we've got to do is create a vacuum at the other end by selling off the peg what we have and sucking the product through faster.
And is there an opportunity to sell the product integrated in a fridge? So work with some fridge manufacturers as partners and put that technology into the fridge.
So it becomes a normal part of your fridge.
Yeah, I think you've seen
a normal function
or Philips or whoever, or maybe with the lower end of the market, because the payback is better. I don't know. Is that an opportunity?
It's kind of, by the time this program goes out, you'll be able to see a little bit of what we've done at the EFRA exhibition from the 31st of August. But the primary part for us is in three elements. One is sold alone, attached, and integrated. Manufacturer partner integrated. Yeah, yeah. If you take a look at what Amazon did now 7 weeks ago when they purchased Whole Foods in the US for $16 billion, effectively what they bought was 250 distribution warehouses.
Mm.
In yeah. localized,
what are they actually buying?
In localized area.
Yeah.
And then the delivery mechanism that they can use out, whether it's drones or vehicles, out to the consumer. But more importantly, what are they delivering? What food does the customer want? And how can they do it more efficiently?
Yeah. Mm, and if really people want to know about your products, they need to go on to smarter.am.
As in Smarter Morning, that's the one. Smarter.am, and you can find out
and they can find. Yeah, and is the fridge cam available now?
It will be available from the 26th of October.
Yeah, so it's going to be available later on this year. But you can get the coffee machine and you can get the eye kettle.
Absolutely, they're available now.
Yeah, I have to say that I don't think I'd use the eye kettle, personally.
But you do
but
like tea.
But the fridge cam, so, yeah. I think, is
the fridge
is
cam sounds brilliant.
Yeah.
I think I might be adding one to my Christmas
yeah.
list this year.
And I think if, yeah, I don't think I would. Would I use the eye kettle? No, I don't think I would. Would you?
I like gadgets. I don't know how much I would actually use it in the end.
Yeah.
But I use a kettle every day. So and if I had an eye kettle, I'd use an eye kettle every day.
Yeah, I think the benefit for me, as you were saying, though, guys, is this thing about being able to set the temperature.
I think that's
things.
The thing
that will
really
incredible.
Get people. Like yeah. if you're a specialty tea person, or if you have children, you need to heat up certain things to certain temperatures. I can see that being really, really useful.
The three elements of that particular product are simply that consumer purchases it either as a wake up alarm, make your tea coffee. Coming home, it's when it arrives, you walk in, you don't have to stand around twiddling your thumbs, or with the formula mode, they are the three key drivers for purchase.
I like the fridge cam idea.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah.
I mean, especially now that I understand what it is, and it's not something you put on the outside of the fridge to catch your partner at 2 o'clock in the morning coming to raid the fridge.
Yeah,
but I'm sure it can do that as well.
Yeah. Probably. I'm sure he'll think about that next time. So please do go on to smarter.am if you want to find out anything about that. And of course, it was great to hear about John's journey.
Amazing journey. Amazing
One
story.
Of the early disruptors in the food sector, true disruptors in terms of New Covent Garden Soup Company. And you can go on to littledish.co.uk if you want to find out about the children's stuff, such as, I think you even have pies and risottos and all sorts, don't you?
Yeah.
Really
mean,
good
in
stuff.
In the last few years, we've extended the
curries
range considerably.
For children?
Yeah, outside of the original ready meal concept. And we've added healthy pizzas, and we've added a whole range of products for in the home. And we've also recently, last year, added snacks as well in the ambient aisle. It's our first venture outside of chill, which we're really, really proud of. So snacks as well. So we have a little dish as a presence, not just sit down meal at home for young children, but also on the go. So that's we're really excited about that.
The chickpea based, aren't they? The chickpea snacks.
That's right.
Pop
yeah, pops. There's a range of savory and a range of sweet, and some are chickpea based. Yeah, that's right. So a healthy ingredient list. Correct.
Very nice.
Mm. Very good. So incredibly interesting. A grown-up show.
Yes, I feel more grown-up now.
I do feel more grown-up. So you've been listening to The Food Talk Show, which is now syndicated to so many radio stations we can't even keep count. And I'd like to say thank you to my fellow presenter, Guy Routledge. Thank you so much, Guy.
Thank you so much,
Sue.
If
you want to recommend any future guests, anybody that's doing anything as exciting as either John or Stephen, please get in touch. And you can follow us on Twitter at Food Talk Show. If you want to listen to any of our hundreds of podcasts now, I think we've got over 200 now.
Is it really?
Yeah, I think so. Please go to foodtalk.co.uk, and we hope you have a good week. Bye now.